So where do 6.5 billion souls end up? Our guest, David Sirita, he's next with us on Coast to Coast AM. David, the movie out in April. Now, is this going to be a DVD? Or are you going to have it on the big screen? Where's it going
to
be?
Well, I'd like to have it on the big screen. We're shooting it in high definition. It's the most beautiful film I've
ever
shot.
It is gorgeous.
And one of the things we're doing here, I mean, From Here to Andromeda is about the end of life on Earth, mass extinction from global warming. When we see Al Gore's movie, The Inconvenient Truth, the last four ice ages were preceded by great CO2 warming trends. And our current warming trend outshines, I mean, it stands way above the last four ice ages, the warming trends that preceded the last four ice ages. So it looks like we are heading towards an iconoclasm. We are heading towards a possible mass extinction. And whether that means global warming produces an ice age or a massive outbreak, you know, a virus outbreak.
Right.
Or, you know, you mentioned all these bees dying. In fact, I even do a scene on that in this new movie about just the sensitivity of my fiance. When she was driving through this field of butterflies, she started crying. And we had to pull the car over and actually take a closer look at them. And when you really think of these little things, bees and butterflies, I mean, butterflies have been around for 130 million years.
That's right.
They survived the dinosaurs. They survived all the mass extinctions. And what's interesting about them is without them, we can't live because they pollinate all of our food.
That's right. That's what our entomologist was telling us the first hour.
So we look at, you're saying all these bees are dying. I mean, we should be more alarmed about that than anything in global warming because, again, without them, we have no food. And no food, we die. And you wonder, you know, why these things are occurring. And then we also, in the film, we look at how will we actually, for those human beings who want to live sustainably, who actually love this planet and respect it, where can we go next if we want to go to another planet? Well, so that's why we start investigating the UFO phenomena, and we look for, you know, are we going to get picked up? Is there going to be a rapture? Is there going to be a teleportation of mass souls to another planet? Or are we going to be teleported off the planet and sequestered until, you know, the mass extinctions, you know, are finished and they bring human life back down onto the planet, very similar to the story of Noah and Gilgamesh, I mean, these tales. Or, you know, are we going to have to find our own way? And one of the things, I don't like to rely on the idea that someone is going to save us. I really believe we have to save ourselves. We have to find our own way to a new home. But then we also start asking the spiritual question, religiously or even non-religiously. If you consider there's 6.5 billion of us living here as souls in these human bodies, and we have this attitude that only less than 1% of us are willing or have the ability to live sustainably due to certain oppressions or repressions inside of ourselves, the question is, who else would want us? You know, are we behaving like a virus? Are there guardian angels on other planets who, because they have beautiful paradise planets, they wouldn't let us in? The question becomes, what happens to an exodus of 6.5 billion souls if we destroy this place? So we actually traveled to New York, and we got an interview with Professor Robert Thurman, who translated the Tibetan Book of the Dead and is the Dalai Lama's, you know, one of his number one scholars in America. And we asked him the question, that actual question. And, you know, in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which I scoured and studied, basically what...
And I've also read the Egyptian book.
Me too. Yeah, I read that years ago.
Yeah.
Very different. Very different look. They seem to have more of a view on, you know, the great leaders having access to the higher heavens than the, you know, the peasants and the workers basically don't have much of a chance. But in Tibetan Buddhism, basically when we die, we approach this supernatural clear light of the enlightened realms, which is one step beyond the pleasure or paradise realms of the heavens. And what happens is most of us fear it because we're spiritually unable to withstand the levels of ecstasy and enlightenment because it's too powerful. So we fear it and we seek reincarnation. That's what the Buddhists, to them it's not a belief. To them they have mapped like an astronaut. Thurman coins the term psychonauts. They have actually mapped the cosmos in the in-between realms. And this is what actually happened. So I'm thinking, okay, in Tibetan Buddhism, everyone is going to be, most of the souls seek reincarnation back in their Earth-like school, but it's not there anymore. It's kind of like a Got Milk commercial. Mm-hmm, you know, got a body? No, there's no more left. So according to Tibet, when I was in India studying with the Dalai Lama in 1996, he's basically telling us where all the souls go and the different compartmental realms they go. Very similar to Catholicism or Christianity or Hinduism. They all have the basic same ideas. The only difference is in Tibetan Buddhism, hell realms are not permanent. People only go there for as long as they need to work out that negative karma, and then it expires. So if you really think about that, where else would we go? So we asked Thurman that question first, and his answer is quite shocking to me because he kind of laughs and he comes from this place of compassion and abundance, and he says there's billions and billions of other planets out there. And I said, are there other organic planets? I mean, NASA hasn't been able to see, you know, where these planets are that can sustain human life. And he says, oh, yes. I mean, there are, in the Buddhist cosmology, there are billions and billions of other planets. And there's so much abundance out there that, yeah, we'll find a new place to go. But he said, eventually, we will seek reincarnation in a realm very much like Earth. And, you know, that may be, you know, because the Earth isn't here anymore, or it can't sustain life for perhaps another 10,000 years until it recycles itself, maybe we'll be in a bit of a bind. But it's really amazing to see him come from this perspective. And then, you know, the real thing is, you know, where are these planets and how do these Buddhas and these great beings traverse the great distances in the universe? So I started to ask him the UFO question from the Tibetan point of view. And at first he kind of ignored the question. And much later into the interview, he said, actually, they do have something that deals with this subject, but from their perspective, these great masters travel through these multiple millions of universes through spacecraft that are enveloped around the master's body. They are not machines. They're actually, he describes these towers, and he names the sutra where these giant towers.
Is it energy?
They're energy manifestations that are, like, it's almost like they have to cloak their spiritual body with an architecture in order to traverse these multiple universes. So that could explain part of the wave phenomena around, you know, even the flying men and some of the flying men phenomena, but also possibly around some of these UFOs. And then he said that there are sutras where they describe these craft as being made of flower petals. And flower petals could be just a metaphor for something really beautiful and kind of swirly. Because, you know, these are, you're talking about sutras that were written, you know, in the 6th century AD, Tibetan Buddhism, and Buddha exists 623 BC. So, you know, these are very old scriptures. And, you know, they didn't have light bulbs back then. I mean, they used the metaphor fire for light.
At least we don't think they did.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and then you look at the Egyptians and you think maybe they really did have electricity. So then we go much further in the interview. We start talking about invisible cities. In Buddhism, there are several names for different cities that are actually on the Earth that are like parallel dimensions to our own planet that we can't see. And until we, according to Buddha, we actually attain higher levels of consciousness that ultimately culminate in permanent enlightenment, which is nirvana. In fact, you don't have to fully attain, you know, full Buddhahood to actually see some of these realms. Apparently, there are cities on our planet that are interdimensional, and I cited Shambhala, which some people know as Shangri-La. And Thurman looked at me.
Saw an old movie about that a long time ago.
Yeah, and Thurman looked at me and he said, Shambhala is not a city. He said, it's a country. It's a whole country. And there are many Tibetan masters who have actually been there, and he said it's sort of, quote, it's in another dimension of Earth, but you can actually go there. It's a real place. It's not a place in your mind, but it's actually here on the planet. So as we got further and further into that, he revealed that there is a prophecy, and he's had conversations with the Dalai Lama about this, that Shambhala will interdimensionally appear to all of us. It will become visible to everyone, and they have a certain date when this is going to happen in their prophecy, and they're estimating it to be 300 years from now. And when this country emerges, which is in the northern regions of our planet, our militaries will gather strength and try to make war against them, and we lose, because very much like Qi masters, they have this power of the mirror in their prophecy, which means if we send a missile at them, the missile just mirrors back at us and destroys us. it's kind of like, you know, in the, these Tai Chi masters, if you send them a negative thought, the negative thought takes you down. The Chi master is untouchable. So all the beings in Shambhala have this power, and once we lose the war, it marks a new... If you think about this, because how this parallels the Christian story of the Revelation, how there's a new heaven and a new earth, and in a way, that's what this is. This is a new heaven actually interfaces with earth, and earth becomes a paradise. And according to the Tibetans, that this period of peace will last 1,800 years. This is what Thurman was saying. But then he said, wait a minute. He was arguing with the Dalai Lama. He said, if this is in 300 years, he said, we're not going to be here in 300 years. And this is all in the movie From Here to Andromeda, by the way. So Thurman's saying, well, this, the prophecy must be a lot sooner than that, because we're getting close to the end right now. So he's kind of debating about how accurate their time, you know, scale is. But what's interesting about this myth in Tibetan Buddhism is that it's so similar to the Christian story, once again, of the Revelation, that at the end of this great war, you know, the Battle of Armageddon, you have this massive judgment period, and then you have the new era of peace, that there's 1,000 years of peace according to the end of the Revelation, and then you have a new heaven and a new earth. So you think about what that means. If earth goes into a higher dimension of energy, these invisible dimensions may suddenly overlap, and suddenly you're able to perceive them. And this is where we go back to Pythagoras once again, and it all comes crashing together, that maybe, once again, in my book Singularity, because of the duality code, because we're in this state of internal conflict, and this conflict produces these three levels of inertia, the first that we age and we experience death, and the second that
Let's explain each one.
Yeah, each one briefly. The very fact that we took in the knowledge of good and evil, which was forbidden in the Garden of Eden, mm-hmm. which I document that the real interpretation of that is that it's not a good thing that we knew good and evil. It's actually the cause of our fall, because we originally started in a state of singularity, in a state of love, in a state of union. In fact, here we are speaking on this great day of love. When in singularity, imagine a state of love is a state of peace and union and bliss where there's no conflict. But as soon as you ingest conflict, the knowledge of good and evil, a conflict can't exist in a vibrational field of love, so it falls. God doesn't kick us out of paradise. We decide to go into conflict. We believe in it, so we ingested it. So now we become the conflict, and because we become the conflict, we are no longer in paradise. We individually, egotistically interpret the knowledge of good and evil individually, and because we do that egoically, all of our interpretations are different, and this causes us to argue and fight with one another, alienate each other from our love because we are seeing things so differently, and we divide our politics, we divide our religions. A single religion becomes divided hundreds of times. All of the great religions have hundreds of divisions. Then there's infighting inside the religion and separations and even killing. And eventually we go to war with each other. So this is, you know, this is all documented in our previous discussions on the first level of inertia. The first level of inertia is war, psychological warfare, and that the very fact that this conflict is inside of us causes us to waste all of our psychic energy, all of our spiritual energy.
Does it drain or waste or both?
Well, it drains. Imagine, you know, positive and negative fighting inside of you, inside of everyone.
Tearing you apart.
It tears you apart and it exhausts your reservoir. So psychically, we only have this tiny difference between the positive and negative. You have a little bit of leftover energy because they don't cancel each other out entirely. And that tiny bit of energy is all we have to perceive our universe around us, which is what I believe causes us to only be able to see from red to violet wavelengths of light to only hear from 20 to 20,000 hertz. It puts us in this little narrow sliver of reality. So what happens is when the earth goes into, when we go into a higher level of spirituality, when we start to vibrate with more and more peace and more love for all beings, and we end this internal conflict inside of us, when Jesus says in Matthew 6:22, if thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be filled with light, which really internally means if we end the conflict inside of ourselves, the duality of good and evil, we become single, we become one. And in that state of oneness, we start to vibrate in a higher frequency. We suddenly have more energy to perceive the invisible universe around us. And that's where I believe Pythagoras was able to see that all of the planets have life on them. And this code, this what I call the duality code, which causes these three great inertias, is actually preventing us from seeing that we're not alone in the universe, that there's life all around us, and that Shambhala and the other invisible cities in other cultures, there are invisible cities in native Indian folklore, there's many invisible cities in Hinduism, and there's, in fact, in Buddhism, the father of Tibetan Buddhism lives in an invisible Copper Mountain paradise, and there are a number of those paradises on the planet. So our planet may have all these invisible countries and cities that we don't see. And so the question is, are some of these UFOs actually interdimensionally jumping from those, from the singularity, from the real universe, what I believe is the real-time universe, which I can actually prove?
Well, that's possible. What about these, and you've heard shadow people on this program before, what if they are passing through these interdimensions?
I think so. You know, I've had personally a lot of experiences with seeing interdimensional beings with my eyes open. You know, it's something that started after, you know, I had this in 1994, I had this massive appearance with, you know, this supremely enlightened being that I mentioned was the teacher of singularity.
And, right.
You know, I don't say his name on the air for certain reasons, but...
Why?
Well, do you want me to... I can say it.
Well, tell me why you don't first.
Well, I just don't want to, you know, get people into a religious...
Well, you're not going to say Beelzebub, are you?
No.
I'm kidding.
I mean, I'll say his name if it's
say
okay.
His first name, sure.
Well, in 1994, when I was bankrupt and destitute, my Green and Blue Corporation raising money for EcoVenture Capital went bankrupt. I went tree planting that summer and was, you know, at the end of tree planting, I basically got fined for back taxes and the government took all my money away. I had nowhere to live. I pitched a tent in my father's ranch in Topanga Canyon, and I was really devastated just over the fact that I couldn't raise any money for these brilliant environmental technologies, nuclear helium-3 fusion, hydrogen fuel cell breakthroughs, and this is back in the, you know...
You had great ideas, but
the 1990s.
No,
I mean, yeah. This is way before Al Gore's movie was out.
Yeah.
And what happened was there I'm living in a tent with no money, nowhere to go. My dad was rebuilding his house that was under construction. There was nowhere for me to, you know, to stay. And a rainstorm came. If you remember 94, we had massive, like, they were like monsoons in 94. And my little tent was flooded, and I started to get hypothermic. And I left my body, and I had no desire to go into the house and get warm.
Mm-hmm.
I just said, God, take me. Those were the words I said.
Please take me, right?
And please take me. And at this point, I had been practicing Buddhism most of my life, and, you know, I was baptized Catholic as a baby. And all of a sudden, I float over to the oak trees, out of body, and I go, wow, I'm out of my body. And there's this giant granite crucifix. I mean, it's dark, beautiful stone, and the crucifix is like the monolith in the movie 2010. And it's got this angelic echo, this beautiful vibration. And there is a baptismal font shaped like a crucifix right beneath it. And the water just calls me to fall into the water. It's just saying, fall into me with all this love. And I fall into the water, and I'm suddenly, all my emotional pain, all of my suffering is gone. And at that moment, just to have my emotional pain taken away was a miracle. And all of a sudden, like a mother carrying a baby in her arms, I was pulled above the rain clouds. I could see the sun hadn't yet risen on the horizon. And I thought, oh, my God, you're dead, David. You froze to death. And all of a sudden, millions of tiny little atoms of light, billions of them, came from below, above, beneath, every direction in the universe. And these little atoms were so bright. It was like millions of diamonds. They came rushing together and instantaneously materialized the body of Jesus Christ in front of me. And in 1 second, he was billions of suns in brightness. I fell on my face. I could barely look at him, and I fell on the ground. I went, oh, my God, I looked at him, and there was so much love and ecstasy, I couldn't bear to look at it. And that was the beginning of me receiving messages about singularity. He actually started to talk to me as I was falling at his feet, looking up at him intermittently, being blinded by his light. And I went, I couldn't believe who I was in the presence of. I mean,
like he changed your whole life.
Changed my whole life. Yeah.
Stay with us, David. Much more to talk with you about. I want to talk about SETI when we come back as well. Search for extraterrestrial intelligence. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We'll take phone calls next hour with our guest David Cerita, but I still have a few more questions for him when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. David, before we get into SETI, I wanted you to finish up on your thoughts about that visitation that obviously changed your life forever.
Well, it completely changed my life, George, because I had been meditating for many years at that point. I was 1994, I'm 45 now. I think I was 33 when that happened. And I actually had three visits with Jesus. The second was Easter morning, 1997, and I reported to, you know, the Catholic Church in Malibu there, and I met with a father there.
Did he believe you, or what did
he
say?
He really did. He believed me. He didn't want me to go public with it, but he started speaking to me and teaching me singularity, which I eventually had to prove in physics and prove in Scripture, which took years of research. And I've read every, you know, published and unpublished manuscript in Christian mysticism there is. And I had to study and study, because Jesus would say things to me, and some of them were difficult to find copies of those things in the canonical Gospels. And I started looking in the Nag Hammadi Library and the Gospel of Thomas. And in fact, there's one manuscript called the Acts of John, and this would blow Mel Gibson's mind. It was banned by Pope Leo the Great, but he actually, in one of my visitations with him, he pointed me to the Acts of John to show me that it was true. And in the Acts of John, which is such a great true iconoclasm against our traditional understanding of the crucifixion, is that Jesus is dancing and celebrating before his arrest with the disciples, and they're the ones who are crying. He can't get them to dance. They don't want to dance because they know that they're going to torture him and kill him.
Well, so did he, right?
What's that?
He knew that too.
He knew that too, but he was dancing and had no fear. And then they arrest him in the Acts of John. And during his crucifixion, to make a long story short, in the Acts of John, which anyone can research on the internet, and they were burning the Acts of John all over the Roman Empire. They didn't want any copy of it to survive. Pope Leo the Great did not want anyone to survive. And what happens is John cannot watch the suffering of Jesus because it's so graphic, just like in Mel Gibson's movie. And then he goes into the cave to weep on the Mount of Olives, and Jesus appears in the cave during the moment of his crucifixion, before he's given up the ghost. And he says, John, remember the dance that I taught you. He said, I am dancing right now, John. I'm celebrating. That's just a body on that cross. He goes, I'm not the body. I am God. I am, you know, basically he's telling John that he's not suffering. And so what I did when Jesus pointed me to the Acts of John is I started to look for more proof. And in Hindu mysticism and Buddhist mysticism, there are seven levels of samadhi which culminate in permanent enlightenment, which is nirvana. According to Hindu, you know, scholars and Hindu meditation masters, once you go into the higher levels of samadhi, there's no perception or non-perception of the body at all. You could stick nails through it. You could, you know, pierce it with lances. You could do anything to it. And there's the master has no perception of the suffering at all. In fact, that is consistent. In fact, one time I was watching 60 Minutes or one of these news shows, 2020, and there was this Islamic prayer going on where once these Muslims, you know, they chanted these certain scriptures, they would go into trance. And in this particular state of trance, anybody within this certain perimeter of this field, you could stick needles through them, torture them, swords right through their arms, and they didn't feel any pain.
No pain, yeah.
And this news anchor actually ran a needle right through the center of his palm, and he didn't feel any pain. And you think about that. If in the Hindu, you know, experience of enlightenment and the Buddhist experience, if there's no suffering at all at that level of enlightenment, the question is, did Jesus physically suffer on the cross? Now, he suffered in a way because he suffered for our sins. He's weeping for our ignorance, for the fact that we keep hurting each other. The very fact that the Romans and his persecutors treated him like that, he weeps inside for humanity. So that wound is still there, but the physical perception of suffering is not really there. It's only there because that organism, that body is suffering.
Well, let's bring this back then to the singularity of all this.
Well, it brings us back to singularity because if you look at the true cause of suffering, what pain is, pain is born out of conflict. As soon as you go from a state of total singularity and oneness and you introduce conflict, conflict produces inertia, friction, heat, which gives rise to pain in the actual organism itself. So when you end, you know, in fact, in the Gospel of Thomas, the very first verse, Jesus is saying that he who understands these things will not, he says, whoever discovers the interpretation of these things will not taste death. I mean, I think that saying is so supported in the rest of the scripture here that he literally means you won't taste death, you won't even feel pain. He's actually telling you that right
there.
Well,
you believe we are trapped, though, in some kind of matrix, right? Of space.
Yeah, I think the knowledge of good and evil, which again was traditionally interpreted as meaning that it was a good thing in the end that we took it in, although if we really understand that God warned us never to take it in or we will die, what happens is it binds us in a state of conflict. It exhausts all of our psychic and spiritual energy. It causes us to separate or alienate us from each other. For example, even Christianity is divided hundreds of times, and we, you know, Protestants and, you know, say the Catholics are going to go to hell because they got it all wrong and vice versa, and you have the Sinn Féin and the bombings in Ireland. You have, you know, the wars between all the different fractions of Christianity, and then you have these three great religions that all have the same God in common, basically fighting in the Middle East, you know, at each other's throats. And really what's happened is this knowledge of good and evil is so poisonous, it has caused us to put up the walls, caused us to go to war, caused us to spend, just look at the financial equation of war. Just look at how much energy is there in a state of oneness financially if we weren't in a state of war with each other. But the very fact that we're at war with each other, we cancel out all of our finances. I mean, all of our greatest resources, all the billions of dollars we spend on going to war and protecting our country from terrorism.
Well, yeah, but that's because, we're going off the wrong path here, David, but that's because those people who promote war are making money on it in a different way, and they're not too interested on spending the money on these other things that could lead this planet, you know, into another, basically, push into the universe.
Well, I totally agree with you. I think, but they're also afraid to be so vulnerable. I mean, when the Cold War ended the first time, and we're possibly now going into another Cold War, if we look at the headlines, there was a sense of vulnerability. I mean, Clinton was shutting down military bases all over the country. We were coming to a new era of peace. We didn't have an enemy. And I think to be a truly peaceful country...
Well, one could also say he weakened us.
Yeah, exactly. That was their perception. And there's a certain point there where you almost think we were so afraid of being so weak and peaceful that we almost wanted an enemy.
See, I've always believed the strongest person on the block doesn't have to fight.
Yeah.
Being that, you can be a patrol officer.
But think of how much money we would have if we attained singularity true peace.
Oh, I agree, but they'd probably waste it on something else.
They'd probably waste it on
something else. Yeah, they won't spend it on the things that need to be spent.
I mean, here we are. This is the irony, and from here to Andromeda. When CNN, September 1st, the headlines were, if we destroy this planet, will science find us a new one? When I read those headlines, I put it in the film and I thought, my God, are we really willing to go that far that we're not willing to change our policies? We'd rather go look for another planet.
Yeah, buy a new house. Let's not clean up the house we own. Let's not repair it. Let's just go buy a new house.
But we don't even know how to get to another house, another star system.
No, and we won't for a long time.
No, and so we're really willing to risk all of that. Because we don't want to make a... In fact, I was interviewing Professor David Phillips at Santa Monica College, and David Phillips has a PhD in psychology and environmental sciences, and he's saying we need a Manhattan-style project to do an emergency transformation of the planet to sustainability if we're going to survive, if we're going to make this 5 to 10 year window that we have to reverse the damage we've already done. And if we don't make that window 10 years from now, maybe too late, even if we go 50% sustainable. And I asked a high executive at Ontario Hydro in Canada, I said, if we even attain the Kyoto Protocol, do you think we're going to beat global warming? And he said, no.
See, you're a believer in that. I'm a believer that we're in a cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And we're in an Earth cycle, as I got to tell you, a lot of scientists are beginning to open up their mouths. They were petrified to say anything about it before, but they're beginning to say the same thing. But
it just takes one scientist. It takes one Tesla. I mean, when Edison invented the light bulb and Tesla redid light bulbs, it changed the world for everybody. Now we can all read in the dark.
You talk about, because I wanted to ask you this before we get to the top of the hour, you talk about SETI, that, you know, they're spending money, they're trying to get electronic messages using their radio telescopes. They can't seem to do it yet. You know, they're going to have this Paul Allen array of telescopes online soon. I hope it works. I'm not sure. You don't seem to think it's going to work.
Well, one of the things we can prove with singularity is that because we know that radio waves and light, you know, which is all the same thing, electromagnetism travels at the speed of light, it doesn't travel instantaneously the way singularity does. And we can't imagine that, you know, when you look at the separation in distances between star systems and galaxies, Andromeda's 2.2 million years from here. If you're sending a radio wave from Andromeda, it takes 2 million years to get here. There's no way they're communicating through radio. They couldn't do it effectively because it takes too long to send the message, and then the message, you know, as a waveform, collides with other waves, and you get distortion. It will never get here. So the point is, now that we know singularity is real, it exists. Einstein's spooky action at a distance has proved it. The Alain aspect experiment proved it, which we've talked about before. So now I'm devising an experiment to actually send the human voice through the singularity, and I actually know how to do this. It's actually really simple. It's so simple when I show, you know, scientists, you know, how it actually works. If I could show SETI, if I could get Seth Shostak's ear to look at this, to look at the Alain aspect experiment, there's a key in that experiment, which, you know, to recap, essentially Alain aspect, the French physicist in 1993, he separated an electron-anti-electron pair, which essentially is a duality. But when he separates the positron from the negative electron, and he separates the two of them, they become mini singularities, but they're in a relationship with one another. And what he did was, when he altered the wave functions of one, the other one responded instantaneously, mm-hmm. not at the speed of light. So that means that there is a way to send information through the singularity between one point in the singularity and another. The question is now, can you send a message through it, the human voice? And I want to do an experiment and send my fiance Crystal's jazz song, one of her jazz songs, through the singularity to see if you get an answer. And I believe there are certain experiments that have already been done that have inadvertently or accidentally stumbled upon this. Now, once we can use the singularity as a tool, not only will we be able to see the first real-time picture of our universe and possibly our own world, but we may actually get an answer from another intelligent civilization. But there's no way in the world I can accept that the radio signals are going to yield any positive results. They haven't for decades now, and I don't think they're ever going to get anything out of it. So I think we have to start looking. You know, when people read singularity, they'll see very clearly why this is a valid option, why we can actually start accessing this. But what it's going to mean is when we start receiving messages, just like in white noise, you can actually hear the very faded voices of the dead or deceased or disembodied spirits. When we access the singularity, I think we're going to start to see that there's a real-time universe that really knows how to communicate over any distance in zero time, and I think that's what they're using. But there's a way to transpose radio signals. For example, this is a really amazing conundrum. The human voice sound only travels at roughly 750 miles an hour. But you can actually get sound to break the speed of sound. And the way you do it is you entangle the human voice as a waveform onto a radio wave. So sound then wraps itself around a radio wave, travels at the speed of light. It's mm-hmm. like kind of like getting on a train, and then you get off at the receiver,
yeah.
and all of a sudden you've obviated the problem. You've got the human voice to travel at the speed of light. You see?
Sure.
It's the same way. One day we will be able to take the human voice and put it on the singularity and send a message through it and go, we're here. Is there anybody out there? Or you can possibly, you know, send a singularity message to Andromeda and see if something comes back from the singularity. And the message could come back very quickly. You know, I think I think we're going to start to see that there is a much more viable way to communicate with extraterrestrial life. Singularity will eventually make wormholes obsolete as a mode of transportation.
How close are we to really doing this?
Well, I think I've actually heard some rumors. When I was lecturing at the Conscious Life Expo in L.A., I mentioned that I wanted to do this experiment, sending the human voice through the singularity. And when I told, you know, one of the people who came to my lecture how I was going to do it, they said that Elaine Aspect, and they know the same, they figured out the same thing I did, how to do it. And it's really simple. So I think they're going to be onto this. I think the world is going to be onto this. And it's just going to open up a whole new level of our understanding of the universe. And all of it, you know, the whole journey of singularity for me started with those three visitations with Jesus Christ. And he teaches me and points me to Scripture. And then eventually I merged Scripture with quantum physics.
With science.
We now have the merging of the two in the field of singularity.
How many invisible dimensions do you think there are on this planet?
I think if you look at the work of Richard Feynman, there are probably millions of parallel histories that are real, what he called the sum of history, sum over history, that every possibility for Earth's existence and every human being's individual lives exists, actually exists. We only experience the one we choose. Now, possibly schizophrenics are able to see two of those possibilities at the same time. But the singularity is yet another thing. It's something even beyond that. So I think what happens is, it's kind of like this. Imagine two fish under the Atlantic Ocean, and they want to go from New York to London. And when the fish are going through the water, they realize that you got to push your tail so hard to go through the water, and the water produces so much inertia, so much weight pushing you back, and it just exhausts you. And one of the fish goes, well, you know, if you get out of the water and you travel through the air on aircraft, you can cross the Atlantic with way less energy. It's way easier. You just float through the air. What happens is the finer and finer strata that you move through, the less inertia you encounter. When you find out that when you get out of air mass, I mean, inside of the air mass, we can do, like the X-15 was doing Mach, you know, 8, apparently.
Right.
Now, when you get out of the air mass, the space shuttle can do 18,000 miles an hour, you know, flying around the Earth, and it can go even faster than that. We have satellites that do 30, 40,000 miles an hour. Now, according to Einstein, in space, which is not a true void, but is a, you know, not a true vacuum, but is somewhat of a void, space is a fabric also. It's just a much more finer fabric than air mass is. You still can't go faster than the speed of light when you move through space. So when you think of these UFOs, when they go invisible, like the one I saw in Berkeley, after 20 minutes it goes invisible, what they figured out is you can't move through space because it's too heavy. It's going to eventually push on you, especially when you approach the speed of light. It's going to crush you. And then you can't turn at those velocities to avoid incoming debris because the G-forces on the turns will kill you if you have mass. But if you get out of space, you see what I mean? It's like the fish getting out of the water, and you go to the next the next strata, which has even less inertia than the fabric of space, you can move even faster. How many of those strata there are, oh my God, I think they ultimately culminate in singularity, which is an infinite zero point. You never really reach absolute zero singularity. It's infinite. But the higher you evolve spiritually and technologically, the more of those strata you can jump through to get to lower and lower inertial fields, meaning strata that you can move through with less inertia, meaning it takes less and less energy to move through those strata. What's interesting, what Paul Dirac discovered in the quantum level in the singularity, is that if you're in a state of conflict, the singularity rejects you. It only accepts you if you become one. As soon as
sounds
you have
like
conflict.
Does it have a brain behind it?
I think it has intelligence behind it. So it won't accept you if you're in a state of conflict. So this way the universe protects itself from conflict spreading all over the universe. It can only be sequestered in these little locations. In the Apocryphon of John, when Jesus tells
hold
John...
Hold on, we got to take this break. We'll be back.